Good afternoon, everyone. For those of you who are just joining us, welcome to the Publishing Business Virtual Conference and Expo. And for those of you who have been attending sessions all morning, welcome back. Hope you all got a little something to eat and spent some quality time in the networking lounge, exhibit hall, or the resource center. I'm Brian Howard. I'm the editor-in-chief of Book Business Magazine and part of the team that's putting on this little digital shindig today. I'm pleased to welcome you to another great live session, Organizations Confronting Digital Change. We've got a great panel today, and they've got a great presentation prepared for you. But before I do anything else, I'd like to take a moment to pay the bills and thank our generous session sponsor, Xerox. Okay, so before we get started, let me point out a few quick tips on how to make the most of today's live webinar. First, if you have any technical difficulties, troubleshoot by clicking on the Help widget at the bottom of the console. It's the one with the question mark. Or let us know in the Q&A box. You can also use that Q&A box to submit questions to today's panelists. We'll be addressing select questions at the end of the hour, but we encourage you to send them in as you have them at any time. Please make sure you turn off any pop-up blockers on your computer so that you can utilize all of the widgets on this console. To figure out what all those widgets do, please click on the Tips for Attendees widget below to learn how you can customize your experience today. Did you know that you can even tweet right from the console? Lastly, if you leave this session at any time or would like to view it again later, you can access the entire presentation from the auditorium in the Publishing Business Virtual On-Demand Environment, which will be open for 3 months beginning on Monday, September 17th, 2012. Okay, so let's get to our session. First off, I'd like to introduce our esteemed panel. Today we welcome Holly Gilley. Holly is VP of Product Development for Human Kinetics, the Champaign, Illinois-based information leader in physical activity and health. I'd also like to welcome Anya Wachowski, Managing Editor of the Harvard Business Review Press. And moderating today's session, we have Chris Lederer, a director on the Media Practice Division at Alex Partners, who brings some 20 years of experience with companies including Open Road and HarperCollins. Chris will be leading today's discussion, and so I will turn the floor over to him. Thank you, Chris.
Hey, Brian. Thanks for the introduction, and thanks very much for inviting me to participate. I'm going to lead off and talk about digital change in a strategic context. I'm going to give a high-level perspective and identify some of the big issues and kinds of questions that we should all be asking. Then I'm going to hand it over to Anya and Holly, who are going to talk about their practical experiences at their own individual companies. We're each going to try to talk for 10 to 15 minutes. We have a live clock here that we're watching, and then we're going to answer questions that you all have. Make sure that as you have questions that pop up, feel free to type them and send them, and Brian and the gang here will keep an inventory of them so that we get them. So let me get started, and I'm first going to give you a few background thoughts on the session itself. About a month ago, when the publishing business folks came to us, they had already defined the session name. For me, I found it kind of interesting. The name, as you know, is Organizations Confronting Digital Change. I found it kind of interesting, the use of the words. My first thought was that it could easily have been flip-flopped around a little bit, maybe to something like Digital Change Confronts Publishing, which, of course, is something that we might hear from a Roger Sterling type or lots of the folks that we know around the publishing business, hoping that it's all just going to go away. My next thought was kind of focused on the word confronting and confrontational. I was wondering if we should really be starting to talk about this as a hostile situation, or if we could still talk about it as instead something like experimenting with digital change or even embracing digital change. And when I started looking around, I came across another quick quote by Marshall McLuhan. And he, even in 1964, used a lot of very provocative language. Among other things, he said, change in this case, he was talking about television changing the radio environment. He says it never ceases to oppress the older media until it finds new shapes and positions for them. And I think as I kind of reflected on the title for this session, I felt like this was much closer to my experience and probably closer to everybody's experience on the phone line today as it relates to digital change in the book publishing industry. So it's kind of with that background that I want to provide a strategic context for the change that we're seeing in the book publishing business now. I've got about six slides here, and my message is summarized right on this page. The first message is that confrontational is appropriate, that digital change across media businesses is truly confrontational. It requires us to be active and aggressive. The pace of change in publishing today is only accelerating. We'll look at some data that shows that. The urgency and approach that we take, however, it does really depend on the publishing program and activities that you're pursuing today. And obviously, with my marketing and business hat on, it depends on your market and your consumers first and foremost. We are seeing an evolution in digital models, I said, in kind of a trite way, an evolution from a 1.0 to 2.0, but really the digital experimentation that's been going on for the past 2 years is really becoming more fundamental, and I'll touch on that for a minute. There are some successful models to look at, and the ones that I suggest are outside of book publishing, which are always interesting to consider. And lastly, I'm going to raise and identify a set of questions that we should have answers to across strategic, economic, and publishing areas as we move forward in our digital pursuits. So what's some of the data say? If you look at how different media businesses have been affected by digital change, confrontational is probably too soft a word. If you look at the newspaper business, it's half the size it was 10 years ago. It's more dramatic in recorded music. Magazines is following much the same path, and there's data that, you know, even as recently as the last quarter that tells us that even some of the largest flagships like Time magazine is down 30% in terms of circulation quarter versus quarter. So change is indeed confrontational and dramatic. For the book business, we all look at, see, listen to a lot of pundits, see a lot of data in the dailies and also in the more kind of quarterly and annual research reports. And the consensus certainly is that the pace of change for the book publishing business is accelerating, especially with recent rulings and whatnot on the digital side of things. I think everybody's expectation, I put the numbers aside, I think that the numbers on this page are probably a bit on the dramatic side, but certainly from where projections were 2 years ago about the impact on the traditional business, we're now, I think, have a consensus that the digital impact is going to continue to accelerate. I think that it's important to pause for a minute around the provocative statements and the projections and recognize that it's not a one-size-fits-all answer when it comes to digital in the book space. And I didn't put a lot on this page, but I thought I'd ask everybody on the phone to think about what a religious publisher might have to think about when they look at their publishing activities. So, for example, a typical religious publisher might have a program that touches a bunch of different areas, starting with Christian fiction, moving to nonfiction, including Bible and reference, and then potentially devotionals and prayer kinds of content. I would argue that in this context, and it's a simple one, it suggests, I think, your first answer to the questions on this page would be they should be different. Christian fiction, looks and feels a lot more like a romance publishing program that has penetration in digital of up to 50% and a very well-developed reader base on their Kindles reading a number of books every week. That's a very different digital proposition than it is for Bibles or devotional product that are often kind of very gift-oriented. So first and foremost, think about how your publishing program, and in particular your customer base, is interacting with digital products today. Now, as it relates to models, I think that it's fair to say that we're seeing an evolution in how we're talking about and moving forward with digital publishing models. The first phase, I think it's fair to say that it was mostly experimental. We were all talking about new versions of books called e-books. We were talking about putting them on readers, and then we had this great thing called a tablet. Our go-to-market approach was really based on defining a traditional supply chain in a digital way, so supplying e-books through traditional channels, and experimenting and doing a lot of test and learn with partners, with startups, and internally in little Skunk Works organizations. I think today the changes are now becoming more fundamental. As I said, it's digital's here to stay. It requires a very proactive approach. And from an organizational perspective, a lot of publishers are now starting to make much more fundamental choices around how to go to market and how to design their organizations. So if you look at kind of where we were and where we're going to, again, just to frame the world for us today, a lot of the conversation is moving from e-books to conversations of content and even brands, the dreaded B word. Instead of tablets, or in addition to tablets and readers, obviously mobile and social devices and platforms, and really a cross-platform perspective is what the publishing programs are working on now. Google's got a great report out this week that's starting to put some data against those activities. Instead of testing and learning, we're talking about data and analytics. We're talking about building new parts of our organizations that can do sophisticated pricing analysis, doing analysis around discovery and all those kinds of activities. We're developing author tools. We're developing CMS platforms and CRM platforms to support marketing activities. And those are all data-backed. And lastly, we are starting to rethink channels. We're talking about audiences instead of retailers or in addition to retailers, and we're contemplating community approaches and potentially even direct-to-consumer types of go-to-market approaches. We're seeing some successful models out there. I mentioned that these are ones that are not in the publishing business, but I encourage you guys, as you're developing and thinking about models, take a look at what the FT is doing. Take a look at what Reuters is doing related to videos and others, and we might find some interesting things going on in those organizations. Lastly, before I hand it over to Anya, I'd like to just suggest that we think about this now in a more fundamental way, beyond experimentation and towards a systematic go-to-market approach. When we do that, we're going to have to start to answer a set of questions in a very collaborative way that start with market questions around customers and competitors, redefining those and developing a deeper understanding, and importantly, starting to ask the tough questions about how much money I need to invest and what's my cost structure look like today and is it really sustainable? And or how do I reset it so that it can be sustainable going forward? My last thought is that, you know, the bottom two C's of this chart around capabilities and especially culture may be the most important ones. building the right culture around innovation and digital are going to be critical for long-term success. So at the point 15 minutes, I'm going to hand it over to Anya to talk about her experiences and lessons learned at Harvard Business Review Press.
Great. Thanks so much, Chris. I'm Anya Wachowski. I'm managing editor here at Harvard Business Review Press. And I'm going to talk to you a little bit about our HBR singles program. The singles are basically what you think of when you think of a Kindle single, which is short, digital-only or digital-first content at a low price point, basically anything that's between the lengths of a traditional book or an article. And I think this actually is quite relevant to what Chris was talking about in terms of confronting digital and how we're approaching that as particularly the idea of embracing digital. You know, we definitely see digital as our future here at HBR, and we think that this particular product line is a way to embrace that. And I think perhaps some of the lessons that we've learned are going to be relevant to any other publisher who's looking to either start a short-form content product line or really any new digital product line. So I wanted to just start by talking a little bit about HBR Press. Quickly, we're a fairly small publisher, 45 titles a year. We have 30 employees here, and we haven't hired anybody new for this particular product line. It's all existing employees. And we're part of Harvard Business Publishing, which also publishes Harvard Business Review Magazine, very successful website, hbr.org, as well as some other channels that we have here. We started our transition to digital back in 1999 when we started converting some of our books to the old ebook formats. And our most recent success this summer is that we're actually selling some ebooks directly from our website, direct to customer. So we'd love if you'd go check those out. At this point, about 15% of our sales are coming digitally. And we've done a lot of experimentation with enhanced books. We've released three enhanced ebooks through the company Vook, which have some video and PowerPoint in them. But as we were doing that experimentation with those kind of enhanced ebooks, we found ourselves asking a number of other questions that we hadn't been able to answer yet. For example, what other shapes and sizes does content actually come in if it's not limited by the physical format? Or how can we innovate within traditional ebook channels, which is what I'm calling Kindle and iBooks, instead of going outside to try to sell PowerPoints or to try to sell apps, which we know maybe a little bit less about at this point? How can we use those channels that are already being successful for us? And finally, how do we prepare for a digital-first or digital-only future? I think this is exactly what Chris was talking about. You know, we see this in our future, and we just don't know how that world is going to be different for us. So about a year ago, we started kicking around the idea of publishing short-form digital-only products, and we realized that that might be a way to start answering these questions in a small way. And we saw some other value, potential value as well. For example, the customer appeal of maybe a book impulse buy, you know, at a low price point and also short content, you're asking less of your customer. They don't have to invest as much money or as much time to get involved in an author's ideas, and perhaps that means they might purchase more from you later, or perhaps that's actually just the right size of a piece of content. We also looked at repurposing content, which is we have a number of different avenues for publishing in our company, and we have blogs and we have books and we have articles, so what could we do to put that content into a different format that actually might be right for it? And finally, staving off disruption. If you look at TED Books or The Atavist or Longform.com as they're becoming increasingly popular in this space, we thought that perhaps business books out of all of those might find a particular home in this length of content and that this is the right length for some business ideas. Perhaps they don't need to be 250-page books. And we don't want somebody else jumping in where we feel that we are very strong in this space and we want to be able to publish those ideas in that length. So where are we now? We've published four singles thus far. Our fourth came out yesterday, the one on the right. We're actually very excited that it's number one in the Kindle store in the business management category as of this morning. These are all about 10 to 25,000 words each, about $2.99 to $3.99 price point. And we have about 10 more in the pipeline at this point. So I thought it might be useful to run through some of the lessons that we've learned as a team as we've begun to put this product line together. And so I'm going to run through separately editorial production, operations, and marketing lessons. So first of all, on the editorial front, we learned pretty quickly that it was smart to acquire rights for the future, so not just acquiring ebook rights. We were very surprised to learn that our audio licensee was very interested in short-form content and has been quickly snapping these up. We also are going to produce a hardcover version of the first single that we released because it's been very successful for us, and we think that this is another way to capitalize on the content and get it out there. And if we had had to go back to the author to negotiate for these rights after the fact, so that might have been more difficult. But since we had done it from the very beginning, that definitely eased the process. One lesson that we definitely learned was beware the mirage of streamlining. We went into this thinking, oh, you know, these are going to be shorter, they're going to be quicker, they're digital, they're like blogs. We'll be able to tell authors exactly what the titles should be and what the jackets should be, and we, you know, we won't brook any feedback. And, of course, that didn't happen. Books are books, authors are authors. On the editorial front, there was still a lot of back and forth, and the author is just as important in the process here as they are in a full-length book. We also learned not to go crazy with timely content. The first couple of these we put out, we tried to get out very, very quickly, and while we were successful at that, we realized that it might not be that important that this content be timely. If we really need to get something out in a couple of days, or more quickly to feed a news cycle, that's what blogs are for. Now we're focusing a little bit more on content that fits the format as opposed to fits a particular timeline. And with my managing editor hat on, I want to talk about planning with an eye on the seasonal list as well. Initially we had thought, well, this is a completely separate product line. We're planning it 2 months out as opposed to 10 or 12 months out like we would plan a seasonal list. But very quickly it became obvious that, especially since we're working with one team here, that we needed to kind of do both at once. And even though we want to be very flexible with these and be able to slot them as they come in, knowing what's coming out in a particular week and slotting them to make sense with our larger program was very important. On the production front, we have two sort of unanswered questions that I think are valuable to raise. One is that we use outside vendors at this point for all our typesetting and our ebook conversion. And for these, as we wanted to do them very, very quickly, we started experimenting with content management systems, which are, you know, used by a lot of self-publishers who are able to kind of drop the content right into the system, and you press a button and you get a PDF or an EPUB or what have you. And so it's very, very quick. On the other hand, it takes a lot more expertise on the part of employees here and a lot of time. So while you're gaining schedule time, could be done in a matter of days as opposed to a matter of weeks, you are committing more resources to the project than you would have otherwise. The other question that the jury's still out is how we manage the process of paged and reflowable content. So we create PDFs of all of our ebooks and we sell those as well, in addition to EPUB and MOBI and other formats that are reflowable. And so that actually calls for two different production processes. And in a regular print book, the schedule allows for doing those processes in series. So first you create the paged book, the PDF, and then use the XML to create the reflowable text. But if your production process is down to a matter of weeks, it might be faster to do those in parallel, even though you're duplicating some efforts. The real lessons we have learned so far are it's really just important for the entire production staff to learn some EPUB basics and even some editors, which is to say knowing how to troubleshoot EPUBs, open them up, poke around, know what the coding looks like, know how to create a MOBI for Kindle and that sort of thing. It really helps with being able to troubleshoot in the moment. We also built a targeted QA plan, so instead of having our proofread up for every single device, we now have a list of what we know to be common problems on each of the devices, so we only have one format truly proofread, and then we do a spot check on the other devices to see how those particular elements are behaving. Finally, this is actually a place where we have been able to keep author involvement low. We certainly don't send them any kind of proofs, and they seem to really accept that because they know of the urgency behind sort of speed to market at this point. And so that is one place where we've been able to cut the amount of time being spent. On the operations front, and that's sort of what we call metadata and file deployment, the key thing to remember here is that just because it's only digital doesn't mean it's just one format fewer. On the metadata development side, if you think of a traditional book, you're collecting and creating metadata from the moment the book goes to your acquisitions team, through list launch, through publication of the book, there's always pieces being added. When you compress that into a couple weeks, you realize that there are a lot of dependencies between those different pieces of data, and you can't just sit down in a room and get them all at one time, that it does take a process to create them. So creating that process was interesting for us. We also learned that a lot of our distributors and vendors sort of assumed that there would be a hardcover book that came with any digital content. So the systems were set up to first define the hardcover and then, or the paper book, and then define the parameters for the digital book. And so talking to them upfront about how to set up a product that's only digital was very important. We learned a lot about what we would need to do differently there. And even then, things came up that we hadn't even thought to ask about. And so it's important to plan for that kind of flexibility. One thing we did discover is that pub dates are just less important when you have digital-only content, where a book pub date is very important because you've communicated that to the world in so many ways. With these, we have just a much more targeted marketing plan, and so if the pub date needs to move a couple days before, it's really not as much of a problem to move it out, which has been great. We've been able to be much more flexible that way. Finally, on the marketing front, we've taken a templated approach with these, which basically means we're using kind of the same targeted approach where we're doing mostly social media and some email campaigns, and really heavily relying on author blogs. However, each campaign is still slightly different, so we've found it helpful to set up mini launches instead of a launch for a whole list, just a launch for one little ebook. And being able to talk about kind of what's different about this book, get everybody on the same page, and identify unique marketing opportunities has been very helpful. For these, we found that author support is actually even more crucial than it is for a typical book. You know, getting the ones that have been the most successful for us have clearly had to do with authors who get out there and blog and just talk about the book at every opportunity, which is something that should be familiar to everybody. But it's really been reinforced us how important that is here. One surprising thing that we found was with Kindle Singles, you know, we thought that was the holy grail to get into the Kindle Singles store, and certainly it's boosted incremental sales, but it hasn't been the make-or-break element for Singles at all. You know, Kindle still sells short-form content if it doesn't come into, even if it doesn't get into the Kindle Singles promotion program. So if you're reading kind of the rules about what they allow and disallow and don't think your content will make it, that doesn't mean it shouldn't be published. And finally, in terms of profitability, unfortunately, I can't talk about specific numbers, but it shouldn't come as a surprise that these are more highly profitable in terms of percentage, but lower dollar-wise. So it takes more sales to make up the same amount of revenue, and we really have to sort of make it up on volume. And so that's something we're really striving for at this point. Finally, just overall, and I think this echoes some of what Chris was saying, the thing that sort of really has come to the fore as being the most important in making this product line a success for us at all is curious people who are willing just to play, to stretch the boundaries of their jobs, and really to be able to identify those people cross-functionally. We started with a very small team, basically one editor, one production person, one marketing person. And as the program has grown, we've grown the group of people who's excited about this and being able to get buy-in that way. Luckily, we also had support from both the top and the bottom from the get-go, which I realize is difficult to achieve, and we were lucky to have it from the start. And I think probably the number one thing we've learned throughout has been to be serious about process. Like as I said, with the metadata in particular, it's not just about compressing, you know, what we traditionally think of as a full year's worth of work into a couple weeks, but it's about learning what piece is dependent on what other piece and how, what the dependencies are and what order everything needs to happen, and about documenting that process so that you can get the author a one-pager about what to expect, to get editors a one-pager about what to expect and what they need to own when. We've also just been serious about learning. We've had a couple after-action reviews to document what has worked and what hasn't, and I think that's been really helpful in helping us come up with processes that work. One lesson that we learned is we originally tried to just insert communications and tracking for these projects, individual projects, into our typical project pipeline. So they would end up getting lost in the conversations of all of our upcoming books. And so we really learned that you need to kind of have a separate pipeline just for singles that helps people kind of see what this particular product line looks like. And finally, we found that connections with startups have been really valuable for us. So in conversations with VUC, with Pressbooks, with the Atavist, and other groups that are really innovating in this space, where publishers sometimes find it difficult to innovate, lots of startups are out there doing it. And if we publishers don't work with them, they're going to disrupt us as well and go straight to authors, go straight to content sources. And so working with them has really helped us see what the opportunities are, and in some cases we've been able to partner with them very successfully. So I would suggest that, you know, everybody kind of see what's going out there in the publishing startup world. So that's it for the lessons that we've learned. I want to just remind everybody that you can submit your questions to me or any of the speakers anytime, and we'll get to them at the end of the presentation. And with that, I will hand it over to Holly.
Great. Thank you very much. I'm really excited to be able to talk to you today. And I'm just going to simply tell our story and trust that a few of our experiences have some application to your situation, those of you who are attending. On the slides that you'll see as I'm talking are examples of just some of the business tools that we've developed here, where they just show you some overarching information. I think you'll understand the overall purpose of each one, but if you'd like more information, you can get in touch with me later, or you can just type a question into the question box. To give you some context, I'll tell you a little bit about Human Kinetics, or HK. HK was established in 1974 as a publisher of sports science content, specifically books and journals at that time. Over time, our product mix expanded and includes video, online education, ebooks, software, and several other things. Our main campus is in Champaign, Illinois, right here in the heartland, with other offices in Canada, the UK, and Australia. We have about 260 staff worldwide. We publish roughly 95 print books a year and a whole bunch of ebooks. We have 26 journals and various other products, including video, apps, online courses, and so on. We publish for diverse markets. We have consumer books, K-12 books, higher ed textbooks, professional references, but we publish in a focused content area, that is physical activity, sports science, and health. We are employee-owned. Adaptability, I would say, is a key attribute that we expect of our staff. We put a high priority on constant internal evaluation of products and processes. So we're always looking at what we did and whether it measured up to the initial vision that we had for whatever product it was or the process that we developed. And we try to learn from that and apply that to future products or systems. In our e-publishing journey, we started with adding digital to the print workflow to begin with. And we've recently shifted to a format agnostic workflow, or an XML early workflow. And I'll quickly tell you our story, and then I'll focus mostly on the lessons that we learned. And many of them mirror the points that Anya was just making. HK's ebook journey started in earnest in the winter of 2009. Before that, we had ebook sales agreements in place with a couple of small partners, but nothing big. But in the first quarter of 2009, we started to sell ebooks on a wide scale. Those were PDF versions of our titles, and they were primarily intended to be read on a computer with the Adobe Digital Editions Reader. Those ebooks were sold through our own e-commerce site, humankinetics.com. At that point, we were publishing ebook versions of every new print title that we released, and we were systematically going back and preparing legacy titles for sale in that format, too. Early on, we let Amazon and Barnes & Noble convert our PDFs into the formats they needed for their own e-retailing outfits, because they offered to do it for free for us. But that arrangement didn't let us control the quality of the resulting files or the conversion timelines. Essentially, we never really knew when our ebooks were going to be released, and we didn't know what they were going to look like once they were released. So we started to develop relationships with conversion partners at that point. By the summer of 2011, we had settled into a comfortable adding digital to the workflow pattern. We would make our print books, we'd send our InDesign files to conversion partners, we'd proof the conversions that came back, and then we'd send the final files to our sales partners. In the fall of 2011, we realized we wanted to move beyond that. So we put plans in place to move to a format agnostic workflow. We realized that we really needed to manage our content better, not just convert it at the end of a print process. We could see that in the future, customers might demand that we deliver our content in smaller chunks, or they might want us to create custom compilations for them. We would want to reuse content across disciplines. We definitely need to provide multi-format delivery without relying on external conversion partners. And then we also wanted to release ebooks simultaneously with their print counterparts in all of the channels that we worked with. So to prepare us to meet what was coming our way and then even what we can't see on the horizon yet, we purchased a content management system and along with that implemented an XML early workflow. We finished the implementation of the first phase of that project in March of this year. And now all of our newly acquired content is managed in an XML format. It's stored logically in a CMS, and we're getting device-optimized ebook files from the system, essentially with the push of a button. You may have heard Rory O'Connor's comment in the keynote this morning about anything a publisher does that can be done with the push of a button should be done with a button, and that's sort of where we are with this. We now output EPUB files that are optimized for the Adobe Digital Editions Reader, for Nook, for the Kobo and iPad, and then we output Mobi Pocket files for the Kindle family of readers as well. We're also able to create enhanced ebooks where video replaces still photos in some titles for the devices that are able to support that kind of content. And we have lots more plans to extend the functionality of our content management system and to take better advantage of the flexibility of an XML workflow. You know, we've made big changes over the past almost 4 years. We're doing ebooks in a big way. We do enhanced ebooks. We develop apps. We've implemented a content management system and an XML workflow. We changed our organizational structure to some extent. We've changed some business practices. It's really been a busy almost 4 years. And here are the top five things that I'd consider the most important that we've learned so far. As Anya said, it's really important to get your contracts in order. When we first began to create ebooks of our backlist, we needed to do a lot of contract addenda with authors whose content we now wanted to sell in a new form. So we've since revised our author-publisher agreements so that they cover all the various forms that an author's content might take, things we know now and things that might become possible down the road that we haven't even anticipated. Another really important lesson is that it's important to think content and not book. This is probably the biggest and most important and hardest thing that we've encountered as we've made this transition, and that's to stop thinking in terms of publishing books and start thinking in terms of delivering content. That concept is so difficult, in fact, that we're still working on it. Our acquisition editors are now talking to authors about providing content that might be delivered in a variety of ways, including, of course, print, but also ebooks and apps and enhanced ebooks or online courses and on and on. That approach requires an acquisition editor to really think about markets and how the markets want to consume the content. And because those ways of consumption are always changing, it requires a lot more time to just stay aware of what the opportunities even are. One practical thing that we've done in this regard is to develop new profit and loss analysis tools that let us look at all the costs associated with all the different items in a content suite and then compare those to the expected return. You're seeing on this slide a piece of that P&L. So we're combining the P&Ls for all the different components of a suite, you know, the book, any ebook varieties, any apps that might be derivative, ancillary products, and we compare those costs with the expected sales in all the different markets, including the different discount structures involved. And that lets us get a comprehensive picture of the whole contribution that that content is going to make to our bottom line, rather than just looking at what a book is going to bring. Another lesson is that we need to involve everyone early and often. This slide here is just a snippet from a section of our editorial handbook that talks about who to include in launch meetings for new products. Cross-departmental communication has become essential. We've established really purposeful forums where staff in acquisition, sales, editorial, production, graphics, video, technology, e-learning, e-publishing management together make specific plans for each content suite. And that group that gets together answers questions like, can we make this? How do we make it? How much does it cost to do it? Who should make it? Is it a product development project? Is it a technology project? How long is it going to take to make it? Who will we sell it to? How do they want to consume that content? When we published only books and journals, we didn't have to ask a lot of those questions. It's also really important to keep the organizational structure flexible. Our product mix has shifted a lot, obviously. Today, we need people to do tasks that didn't even exist 3 years ago, and we don't need as many people doing some of the more traditional tasks that are done less often now. But because we hire for adaptability and because we focus continually on internal evaluations of processes, we're positioned really well to move people from one area of the business to another. For example, we've had people move from editorial into content management. We've had others move from fulfillment into sales and marketing positions. We've established an ebook logistics unit that's made up of people with great organizational and system building skills who used to work in other departments. And because we can build new units with people who are already familiar with our processes and systems and who already have relationships with their coworkers, we can spend our time getting the work done and not recruiting and training brand new people. Plus, we get to keep good people on board too. And this also echoes something that Anya said, and that's we've learned that we just need to keep learning and adapting. And it's what Chris referred to as a culture of innovation. You can see on this slide just some of the specific events we have in place to encourage that sort of knowledge development and sharing. You know, the pace of change over the past 6 to 12 months has been faster than I've ever experienced in my 24 years here at HK, and I don't see that letting up. So staying on top of what's going on in the industry and in our markets and with the tools we use to produce and deliver and store and manage our products has to be shared across the company. It's not enough anymore for an editor just to proof copy or a designer just to compose pages. In addition to doing those things, people here need to learn about, say, what new e-reading devices have launched and what features those have and what capabilities they don't have. We have to think about what K-12 teachers are using in the classroom to supplement printed books or to replace printed books. We have to keep aware of the debate on digital rights management and so on. Now, as I wrap up, I just wanted to share a word of encouragement along these lines. I just delivered each of my three kids to their respective universities a couple weeks ago, and that made me think about my own days in college. And I clearly remember going to each of my classes for the first time, you know, that class where the instructors would hand out the syllabus. And I'd go back to my dorm room with all of those syllabi, and I'd look at them together and just become a little overwhelmed with all the pages that I needed to read and all the papers I needed to write and all the group projects that I'd need to prepare. And I'd think, I'm never going to be able to do all of this in the next 16 weeks. But you just crack open the first book and you just read the first chapter. You write the first paragraph of that first paper. You call a classmate and set up a meeting for that first group project, and you just get started. And that's how we've approached things here. When we look to the future and we see all the change that's ahead, all the systems that we need to adjust, all the formats we need to learn about, all the people we need to talk to, it does seem big, but baby steps work. You know, if you can just figure out the one next thing you need to do and then just go do that thing, pretty soon, you know, you can look behind you and realize that you've come pretty far. So if you'd like more specific information about our switch to an SML workflow, our adoption of a content management system, any of the other electronic publishing initiatives we have undertaken, please feel free to get in touch with me at the email address on this slide or just ask in any of the questions. Thanks.
Thanks so much, Holly. Thank you, Anya and Chris. That was all such wonderful information. I kind of want to release it as an ebook myself. But we have a little time left for questions, and I'm going to try to do a lightning round here because we've got some great questions from the audience. And let's do this thoroughly but quickly. Well, first question is, Holly, what CMS do you use? They've been looking for quite a while to find a CMS, LMS that would do some of the things you were doing. So can you share that information?
Sure. We're using R Suite that's built and supported by RSI content solutions, and we've been real pleased with it.
Great. Let's see, Anya, we have a question that says, do you feel it's necessary to produce PDFs as well as EPUB and MOBI? Are your readers demanding that?
So I have to say we were really surprised. When we launched our first single, we were preparing just EPUB and MOBI. And about halfway through the production process, our editorial director stopped by my desk and said, so we're doing a PDF, right? And I said, you know, why would we do that? We just said eBooks. You know, he said, well, we sell a lot of content on our website, not book content, but articles and chapters of our books and case studies in PDF form. So we think maybe we can try longer form content, something between a book and something of that length. And so we very quickly put together a PDF, and we tried selling that along with the EPUB and the MOBI. And I have to say, we were all just absolutely surprised by how many of our sales are coming from PDFs. It's varied dramatically from single to single, but on some of them it's been as high as 60%. And those sales are coming from our own website. And I think we have an advantage there where we have a robust website with a lot of content that people visit quite a lot and are used to coming to buy things like cases. And they're used to them to seeing them in PDF format. But it has continued to surprise us how what we considered previously a legacy format is still quite vibrant. You know, if I were to guess, it's because these are business users who are sitting at their desktops all day. And just PDF is actually the easiest way to read something on your computer screen at this point still. So we are, though we haven't, you know, had customers come to us and demand something in PDF format, we're definitely seeing them buying that format very much so.
Okay. Chris, I have a quick question for you. Someone would like to know about the trends in K-12 educational print publishing.
Yep, okay. I would say a couple of things going on in the educational side. I think first the declines that they're experiencing are probably more dramatic than we're seeing in trade publishing. So I think it's you know, they're somewhere a bit further along in experiencing the declines in the traditional legacy businesses. Some of the big players, Harcourt, Houghton Mifflin is in Chapter 11, as you might know. McGraw-Hill spinning off their education business. So the big guys are really struggling there. And at the same time, it's a space where you've got, you know, everybody from National Geographic to News Corp investing in ground-up digital efforts. So I'd say traditional print side, difficult. And lots of folks think that the digital side of the business has a lot of potential.
Okay. I have a question. Since Holly and Anya both touched on this, I'll ask it of both of them. Can you recommend any source for standard contract language around digital rights? Holly, you want to lead off on this?
No specific, like, published source out there. It's mostly just been sort of organic experimentation on our parts and talking with acquisitions, with sales, just thinking about the different opportunities that might be coming up and thinking about what are fair ways to both the publisher and the author to establish language that lets us all be confident that we'll protect the author's rights, we'll protect the publisher's rights. So, no, I don't have a specific source that we've gone to. We've just sort of developed things as we've transitioned.
I would echo that and say pretty much our process has been exactly the same. The one outside source that I think I'd mention is a little unorthodox, but we, as we've moved into digital and as our authors have been aware we're moving into digital, agents have sometimes come to us with requests for changes to our contract, and obviously in some cases those kind of conversations are adversarial. You're set up to have, you know, different incentives. But in some cases they've actually sort of handed us language that's actually really very useful and kind of delineating the kind of things that we want to make sure we do have rights to. So that's, you know, those might be relationships to look into as well.
And Anya, I asked this of Holly. What CMS are you guys using at Harvard?
We have a CMS for our whole organization, which sometimes works well for the books group and sometimes is a little bit less customized for us than we would like. It's called Alfresco. We have a customized version of it called Dewey.
Okay. One more question, I think, or one or two. Anya, did you do a lot of training with the outside vendors you use, or did you seek out companies that were experts in digital publishing?
You know, I think it's a little of both. We were a lot of the typesetters who we were working with, I think, you know, have obviously seen the writing on the wall and have gained digital expertise as part of their ongoing, you know, attempts to stay ahead of the curve. One of the things that we've been finding in the past year or so is that the quality of some of those digital conversions may not be exactly what we want it to be. When digital sales were only a tiny fraction of our revenue, it obviously didn't make sense to invest a lot of money in trying to make these particularly high-quality products, but particularly given our brand and the fact that this is a growing part of our revenue stream, we're really looking to invest a little bit more, and I think as we do, we will be looking to spend more time and kind of investing in those relationships and making sure that we have the right ones.
Okay. And real quick, Holly, I have a question here, and I might not quite understand some of the terminology in it, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Do your editors and designers find it difficult to make changes to Word documents and re-ingest and re-render content? Have you explored more efficient means, possibly round-tripping XML for InDesign changes through CMS? Is that something you can speak to?
Yeah, and it's a good question. And I have to tell you that we're really only now being able to pull some metrics together to analyze that really well. I mean, it is an inherently inefficient process to go to XML to make content changes, to go back and make those changes in Word, re-ingest into the content management system, and then move on through the process from there. And it would be great to find a way not to have to do that. We've talked about round-tripping and haven't found yet a way that seems like it would be successful for us. So, but it's an issue that we're going to have to keep our eyes on because it does have the potential to become a time suck.
Okay. Well, I'm getting the wrap it up message from our event manager. So on behalf of Book Business and Xerox, I want to thank you again for attending this session, and I want to thank our panelists. I think it was amazing information. If you're interested in discussing anything that you heard during this presentation, we encourage you to visit the networking lounge to chat live with other session attendees. You can also visit the info booth to fill out our show survey to let us know about your experience here today. Please also check out the agenda for the rest of the day. Coming up next on the book track is Discoverability versus DRM, and on the magazine side, we've got Surviving the Death of Display Ads. And be sure to catch our closing keynote at 3:55 as Charles Duhigg, New York Times reporter and author of The Power of Habit, speaks on The Power of a Crisis, How Leaders Teach Organizational Habits Through Accident and Design. And remember, if you can't watch them live, add these sessions to your briefcase and view at your convenience in the on-demand environment. Have a great day, everyone.